Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. It is now or never. Because it takes time. It takes time to fill a sandbag. Right? All of a sudden it starts raining. That's when people start reacting, you know, when everything starts getting bad. It doesn't mean that you can't build sandbags and actually protect your property. Doesn't mean you can't, you know, react, but it hasn't started raining yet, folks. It's going to soon, which is why we need to start filling sandbags. We need to start reading and understanding. If people are ignorant, they can't do what they need to do because they don't know what they need to do or how. This is why in your appeal to heaven, you must, if you're truly sincere about saving liberty, if you're truly sincere about saving the Constitution, you have to become at least a little literate on what you need to do. This is why when we speak of making a call to heaven, right? Making an appeal to heaven, you must learn, pray, and act. Those are the three things that you actually have to do. You got to learn, read, and then you got to get on your knees. Each of these are actions. These are action items. Learn, pray, and act. The secret of what we're doing is all demanding full compliance to the Constitution. We're not looking to just save your ability to have, you know, extra round magazines. We're not here to save, you know, children from abortions or your children from, you know, transgenderisms or your family from vaccinations or getting your medical freedom. Each of these, every single one of the issues that are out there that are getting people engaged, like the Convention of Counties is a new movement that has been created in the state of Washington. Folks, the reality is this movement has been created because of my article, Why Counties Matter Most. It is equally myopic as the Convention of States is myopic, as the those who are trying to stop abortion, those who are trying to save the Second Amendment, those who are trying to save medical freedom, and all land councils, you know, saving the state land, or all of these little things are literally teeny battles that are focused on a very myopic issue. We will never win the war by trying to win those battles. We have to actually win the battle on the Constitution. They have no authority to redefine it. They have no authority to implement things because they say so. We have to challenge their authority across the board on all things. Not, and this is what kills me. forgive me. There are a lot of good patriots that have been completely misled that believe they have to be quasi-lawyers to try to fight the government. No. We're not to go into court, you know, because they believe that you got to go to court to win. No. The court means nothing as long as you don't recognize their jurisdiction. In other words, folks, if they can't make the jurisdiction, they can't prove that they have jurisdiction over something, then you don't even have to go into court. Why would you go into court when we aren't a judiciary form of government? We're a Republican form of government, which means our government are our representatives. They're the ones that need to do the work. But they won't do the work until we, the people, demand that they do the work. And if you send them the message that they got to stop abortion, that's your number one job. You got to save the Second Amendment. That's your number one job. They can only have one number one job that they're going to focus on. This is the same thing with your parents. This is the same thing with yourself. You can only focus on one real thing. I mean, some people can multitask, but that, and that's nice. You know, I know a lot of people that possibly can multitask, but overall, they're working on one primary goal. They have focus to get one thing truly done, and that one thing is full compliance to the Constitution. And it amazes me how yours truly is beaten up because I call everybody else out because they're not willing to unite on the Constitution collectively and demand full compliance and actually holding people accountable by using First Amendment petitions. You know a patriotic organization out there? Then get in their grill and say, where are your First Amendment petitions for the redress of grievances for this particular thing, this particular thing, this particular thing, this particular thing? And folks, all you've got to do is say, I am supporting reclaiming the Republic because they actually have multitudes of petitions and are working on more as we speak. And they actually have a petition that challenges our involvement in world organizations like the UN, World Health Organization, and so forth, because it's unconstitutional. The federal government cannot create a treaty that is not within their enumerated powers. I'm going to go on and on, and I can really go on, but this is all about our appeal to heaven, and it's all about, this all connects, folks. It's all about full compliance. I've said this before, and I've actually said this and kind of had some profound effects, so I think it's worth repeating. When there's things that are profound, when I actually have a conversation with somebody, and it's almost like you feel the spirit, the burning in your bosom, when you oh, wow, that's like the spirit's talking to you, folks. For the last days, we can go back long before Christ was even born into the Old Testament, and we see scriptures that speak of his coming, speak of his life, but they also speak of the last days. They term it the great and dreadful day of the Lord before the end comes, the apocalypse, these types of things. And so I believe it's Ezekiel. It might be Isaiah, but I'm pretty sure it's Ezekiel, where Ezekiel talks about how in the last days, the people will come to the knowledge of our Lord and Savior. And they will receive that knowledge through reading the scriptures. And as they read the scriptures, they will hear the prophets of God speaking from the dust to them. Folks, I am here to tell you that those wise men, those prophets speaking from the dust, are not the only ones speaking of the dust, delivering the truth that we need to understand. God, our Creator, is not in the business of saving nations. He's in the business of saving souls. He blessed us with this nation. We've made the academic case in reading every year George Washington's proclamation on Thanksgiving, where the nation actually sanctified the Constitution in a day of fasting, prayer, and service to the Lord. That is literally a Christian act of sanctifying something that someone was blessed. You don't just have a big feast and say, well, aren't we blessed? No, that doesn't sanctify anything. What truly sanctifies the something, you know, a blessing that we've received is actually humility, prayer, fasting, and service. We go through it all here. And I'm not the right guy. You know, I'm only right because I've actually learned and listened through the Spirit and understanding why these things are so important. I know I'm not the best. I know I fall short in articulating these truths. I have problems. I mean, I can't get people's names right. I know the words, but I struggle with just articulating them and actually enunciating them properly. I have problems. I am not perfect. And I don't take that as a point of pride. I take that as a challenge for me to continually try and do everything I can to do his will. I'm not in this for the money. And you can quickly start separating the wheat from the chaff when you start identifying those who there's money involved and those who are all about the truth. Because, you know, there's that adage, it sets you free. That means it's not encumbered by money. And there, that knowledge is accessible and free for you to go grab. I didn't pay. As a matter of fact, I didn't go to a college to learn about the Constitution and waste my money at Hillsdale College. I actually read these papers and read and heard the words from the dust of these men. That's why I can say this. This is why we read these documents. We call upon you, challenge you to read along with us. Go and get the ratification debates. They're on our academic source documents page and read along. One of the things I'm going to do now that I've kind of wrapped up all the obligatories other than the final one, I'm seeking people to demand a conversion of our election of the president to back to the constitutional process. It should be. We the people are to choose our electors. You don't want your state legislature to actually choose who goes into this, into the representative, the House of Representatives for you, right? So let me ask you this. When you look at the Electoral College, who we're supposed, we the people are supposed to choose, just like our own representatives in the House of Representatives, we're to vote for two people. Every federal election, every 2 years, actually every 4 years for the Electoral College, every 2 years we're to vote for our representative in the House of Representatives, and on the fourth year, we're to vote for an elector to choose the president for us. That's how it's supposed to work, folks. So the states all have come along and said, you know what, we're going to allow the parties to do this, and we're going to allow a democratic process, winner take all. Well, what's keeping the states from actually applying that same principle to your House of Representatives? Well, if the Republicans win, then all of the representatives in the House of Representatives will be Republican. Why don't they do the same thing? Why do they not lump representation in the House of Representatives the same as an elector? As far as I'm concerned, they are both representatives of those people in that congressional district. Technically, two of the electors go to the senators, or I should say the state legislature, right? Because that's where that suffrage is, and that's why they get two votes for the state senators or the state legislature. So my point is this, is why do we allow these things to happen? We have to start standing on what the truth is, which is why I am willing to run for president of the United States. And I am willing to do that constitutionally. I am not going to get on my knees and bow to the RNC and all of the state's GOP party leadership. I am going to stand on the Constitution, and I need you, we the people, to stand on the Constitution and stop this drift, even a further drift to a democratic government of popular vote and mob rule. This is why I'm doing that, and I'm hoping everybody understands the importance behind this. I'm here to help, folks. I'm not from your government. And oh, by the way, I, just like everybody, are not only just infallible, I am mortal. I am not going to live an indefinite amount of time. And that's why I keep telling you it's now or never. Therefore, let me dive into what we're going to try to cover. I'm going to wrap up on the Utah Enabling Acts today. On Monday, I am going to walk everybody through the Tory Acts and the evolution of America and these colonies of Britain, the 13 colonies of Britain that broke away and evolved into this constitutional republic. I'm going to walk you through those key documents. I'm going to point to the key things in these documents that actually and unequivocally help you understand how and what really happened so that when you hear these great patriotic, good-hearted people telling you the doctrine of magistrates, you will know with an assurity that the doctrine of magistrates died when the Constitution was ratified. And we, this new republic took on a new form as a hybrid constitutional republic. And so I dive into what that hybrid constitutional republic really entails, and it's in my next article. By the way, my next article is even more wordy or longer than the Why Counties Matter Most. But I'm here to tell you, folks, if you want the truth, if you want to see the academic source documents that support everything I'm telling you, then start reading. That's how we fill the sandbags. You know, I've been telling this to a lot of people, and they marginalize this absolute finite amount of time we have. We do not have an indefinite amount of time. Time for everybody is finite, and nobody knows when their time will come when they're done on this earth. I don't know, and this is why I try to speak with a level of exigencies that helps everybody get a little more motivated to not be dependent upon GR. Because bottom line, GR isn't the guy that can do this. There's not one man that can do this. The only thing that's going to save that U.S. Constitution is a majority of states in the Union. That's a lot of people. The only way you're going to save your state and your state constitution is by a majority of the counties in that state seizing and taking control of their state constitution. And the only way you're going to get those counties to actually do that is getting a majority of the people in your county, or by electing good county commissioners to take back your county from the state and the federal government. Folks, that means you have to do this. You have to lead. You have to get involved. You have to actually stand up and say what's right and what's wrong. And you can use all the documentation we give you and let them speak for you. This is not a big hurdle. I mean, when Moses had to go to Egypt, I just find it fascinating that Moses was fearful of his ability to speak because of the lack of time and his lack of profound knowledge. I mean, there's no doubt he knew he was talking to God. When he was speaking to the burning bush, he was speaking to the Creator, and he was probably speaking to both the Father and the Son. The point is that when he had to go speak to the Pharaoh, he basically, kind of like Jonah, shrugged it and said, I can't do this. And that's why he was told to take Aaron with him, that Aaron would be blessed to be able to say the things that needed to be said. Aaron was a man of the priesthood, which is why the Aaronic priesthood was named after Aaron, his brother. He was a godly man. And so God basically, and it happened to be his brother too, his actual living brother. You can't call these coincidences, you know, insignificant, folks. So the fact is, we don't have to rely upon Moses. We don't have to rely upon any one person. We can rely on him. We can rely on our Lord and Savior. We can rely on the Creator. They will bless us. They will give us what we need so that we can be successful. He did this with the framers. He's done this throughout time. He's proven that he loves us. Why do we have to just think that we can't do this? Why would we not think that he would love us too? We just have to start behaving properly and doing what we need to do and stop denying the Spirit. Anyway, so let me dive into the Utah Enabling Act. So the last thing that I read and I had to jump out and go, hey, this is so important, folks, that we cannot marginalize this. And so in the Utah Enabling Act, we were reading Section 12. And in Section 12, it all started with this, that in lieu of the grant of land for purposes of internal improvement made to new states by the 8th section of the Act of September 4th. Now, actually, I'm going to write this down because I've got to get this. September 4th, 1841. Because this right here, folks, is a new document because I read this, right? So why is this important? What's GR talking about? I've never looked this act up, but I now have to, because this is the act that they referenced to be able to say they can control states coming into the Union. It had nothing to do with the corporations and the Organic Act of how they were controlling states. This right here is actually an exposure of the belly of the unconstitutionality of them actually telling states how to join the Union. This is how they redefined everything in admitting states into the Union. And it actually happened in 1841. Now let me ask you folks, why and what was so significant around 1841? A gentleman that happened to be known as the father of the Constitution passed away just a few years before this. And they needed to get enough people on board with actually doing something that very few people knew would be unconstitutionally wrong, but they had to get enough people to actually be willing to do it because those people that were in office kind of knew. And so they had to get enough people to actually say, unquestionably, we can do this, when the reality is they didn't. They can't do it. They didn't have the authority. So now I got to get this act, and actually this is going to become a part of the repertoire, or this is going to become a part of the academic learning, because we want to expose to you each of these steps. That's why we went through the Organic Act already. We want to see each of these steps of how we evolved going down the right path and these types of steps that took us down the wrong path, like the Bank Act and creating a bank. They had no authority to do that. That was very clear, especially a bank that created commercial products. It's one thing to create a bank for the funding of a war or for that type of purpose, but to do that through the Federal Reserve, no. To have a private institution do that where our own government has no control over it? Absolutely not. That's almost like saying we have a president, but we're actually going to, you know, the executive of the United States, Congress, and the Supreme Court are going to abjure the constitutional standards and the mandates that, you know, the president set these things, Congress does these things, the Supreme Court does things, and they're going to basically abjure all of these roles and responsibilities to the King of England and let him make all the decisions, make all the laws, make all the judgments and foreign affairs and treaties, giving him all the power. They can't do that. The Constitution does not give them the ability to abjure their own responsibilities, their own powers, their own roles. Only they can do that, and the only way they can abjure that is through an amendment to the Constitution. And we go through, and that's why we're going through the ratification debates. It is black and white, folks. The only way the government can change what they do and doing something and or having a role, responsibility, power, what have you, the only way that can happen is through an Article 5 amendment. All right, so back to the Enabling Act. So GR is going to do, again, he's kind of telling you while he's actually working with his computer and opening up a new notepad and putting that September 4th, 1841, which is what we call the grant of land purposes for internal improvement, and it's Section 8 of that act. So, boom, that's what I've captured. So I'm going to go find that, and we're going to go through that later this year, probably once we're done with the ratification debates. Now, we're going into break, so we'll come back and finish the Utah, because there's just a couple pages left. But most of these things are really important to highlight, so we should be able to get through this today. But I'm going to expound upon this to the details that I think you really need to understand, because many of the things that they're doing in these enabling acts is unconstitutional. The cat is out of the bag and is just running amok among us. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me start Section 12 over again. That in lieu of the grant of land for purposes of internal improvement made to new states by the 8th section of the Act of September 4th, 1841, which section is hereby repealed as to said state, and in lieu of any claim or demand by the state of Utah under the Act of September 28, 1850, and Section 2479 of the Revised Statutes, making a grant of swampland and overflowed lands to certain states, which grant is hereby declared, is not extended to the state of Utah. In other words, they've made up all of these laws and all of these acts. And so I got to highlight all of this so that I look up all of these things, because all of these things are clearly overreach. Folks, the only land the federal government can possess is enumerated in the Constitution. They have the authority in the Constitution to possess a ceded land for the seat of government we call the District of Columbia, which it cannot exceed 10 nautical miles. And it is to be acceded by a state. And actually two states acquiesced, which was Maryland and Virginia, which created the District of Columbia. The only other land enumerated in the Constitution for the federal government to possess are forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings. Now, in Utah, I don't see a coastal water, so dockyards would not be applicable. It would be stupid and imbecilic of the federal government to claim that they need to have a dockyard on the Lake of Salt Lake. In other words, because that dock or that lake is all self-contained within that state. It doesn't border, that lake doesn't border an international land or an international country, you know, like Lake Superior. Canada's on the other side. So they may have to have dockyards in the Great Lakes that actually have a foreign nation on the border. And they may have to have dockyards, may have to, between states for a needful building, but maybe not dockyards, but a needful building on the ports but of a lake that would, you know, bridge two states. Maybe like Iowa and Ohio, if that's the case, or Pennsylvania, and, you know, and so forth and so on. So because they may have the need to actually kind of make sure the weights and tonnages, you know, have a little office there to just make sure that the things that are going back and forth between these two states, you know, is copacetic, what have you. I mean, that would be a needful building, possibly, possibly. But the fact is, no dockyards in the state of Utah, but they can have forts, magazines, and arsenals and needful buildings. That's it. So what they're saying here is all of these grant lands, and now they're actually saying that for these grants for swamps and those types of things to be extended via these resource documents, they're saying the state of Utah can't have that. In other words, the Great Salt Lake is not attainable by the state government. The federal government is holding that as theirs. And you know what? I don't see salt lakes. I don't see forests. I don't see, you know, land reservations for indigenous people or any type of reservation for any purpose or for any person, maybe even refugees or for concentration camps for Japanese during World War II. In other words, the federal government is not in the business and cannot regulate land other than territories for the purpose of making a state. That is in Article 4. That is not a power. They can't just go and create land and say, this is now going to be the United States land and not a state. The federal government was forbidden to actually be its own state because it would then give it the ability to become an equal parent. This was all in the ratification debate. So we're actually going to get through many of these things because each state had its own little different focuses. Virginia is the mother of understanding the Constitution probably more than any other state just because of their focus. But anyway, so they go basically, the following grants of land are hereby made to said states for the purposes indicated, namely, for the establishment of permanent water reservoirs for irrigation purposes, 500,000 acres for the establishment of maintenance of an insane asylum. In other words, the federal government said you had to have insane asylums. 100,000 acres for the establishment and maintenance of school of mines in connection with universities. So in other words, they had to have an educational university so that people would understand how to do mining and basically extracting elements and so forth. This federal government's dictating this. 100,000 acres for the establishment of maintenance of a deaf and dumb asylum. 100,000 acres for the establishment and maintenance of a reform school. 100,000 acres for establishment and maintenance of state normal schools. And 100,000 acres for the establishment and maintenance of an institution for the blind. 100,000 acres for minors. Hospitals or for disabled minors. 50,000 acres are hospitals for disabled minors, 50,000 acres. The United States Penitentiary near Salt Lake and all lands and apparatuses connected within the set apart and reserved, therefore, are hereby granted to the state of Utah. Oh my gosh, folks. They're literally telling them exactly how to do their job, what to do, and creating these institutions. The said state of Utah shall not be entitled to any further or other land of grants of land for any purpose than as expressly provided in this act. And the lands granted by this section shall be held appropriated and disposed of exclusively for the purposes herein mentioned in such manner as the legislature of the state may provide. So it begs me to go through this, to add up all these 100,000 acres and to figure out what that is in contrast to how many thousands of acres are in the state of Utah. This way, folks, we could actually and mathematically say, well, Utah was granted this land for these very specific purposes, but all the rest is to be retained by the federal government so that you can actually see what that amount is. And, you know, when they talk about 100,000 acres for schools, I don't think when we just talk about this particular school for minors, 100,000 acres for that. I don't think that they have a school for minors for 100,000 acres. So here's the question. Because things change and these enabling acts change, is a state locked in? And I'm going to tell you no. But is a state, why does the state feel that they're locked in, that they can't change these things? Because technically, a state at any point in time can actually have a constitutional convention and... the enabling acts are off the table. the federal government cannot be. I mean, because this is how we can bypass these things. Because bottom line, even though the federal government is in joining the union, we did these things. Afterwards, we can actually say these things don't cut it. They're not cutting the mustard. These things have been actually a detriment to this state and its sovereignty. And now we're going to actually have a convention to undo all of these things. To be clear, and I hope everybody gets this, that the reason and purpose for a state constitutional convention is to clean up all of this. Therefore, I talked about this myopic movement of having a county convention, a convention of the counties for a state constitutional convention. That right there, the way they're playing this game, they're just trying to say, we're only going to do this one thing. Going into that and doing that one thing, one, it won't pass the mustard because there's all sorts of problems. And I'm not even going to get into the constitutional academic issues on that. The point is this, that almost every state in the western areas, from the Indiana admission into the union and after, all states that entered into the union afterwards have all got problems within their constitutions because the federal government's created stipulations in them coming into the union that they had no authority to do. Therefore, many of the state constitutions have been formed unconstitutionally because the federal government mandated those things to be done. In other words, they had no authority to do that, and if the state followed it, it has to be undone, which means that all states need to go into a constitutional convention and say, okay, you didn't have the authority to do these things. Now what? And, oh, by the way, let's say you have a real progressive state. They say, oh, well, we're going to give them all of our land. We're just basically going to, you know, lease this land for the state purposes and let the federal government possess all of our land. Every person's property, all state parks, everything, they're going to control every square inch of this state. Even if they asked to do that and they put it in their constitution, it holds no water because the federal government has to have the constitutional authority to possess that land, which is why I just gave you the instances of land or for the purposes of land, what the federal government can possess. Forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings. Those five types of lands. That's it. They can't possess states. They can't possess Puerto Rico and control it. It either has to become a state or it gets set free. And it stands on its own. And it no longer has any union privileges or any privilege of being a part of this union. We got to close out all of these bad mishandlings by our federal government. We actually need to go after all of these old presidents that have been culpable of doing these bad things, such as Obama, Bush, Clintons, all of them. They all violated their oath of office. You know, like when we look at what happened to Haiti. Anyway, so Section 13 is what we're going to get into now. And this actually has a highlight equally as well. And it says this, that all land granted in quantity or as indemnity by this act be selected under the direction of the Secretary of Interior. So in other words, all land that we didn't grant you is under the direction of the Secretary of Interior from the unappropriated public lands of the United States within the limits of the state of Utah. So that right there, the unappropriated public lands of the United States had to be a part of that act. And so those are the things that, you know, make us go, what? Why? How'd this happen? So, Section 14. The state of Utah shall constitute one judicial district, which shall be called the District of Utah, and the circuit district court thereafter be held at the capital of the state for the time being. The judge of the said district shall receive a yearly salary of $5,000 payable monthly and shall reside in his district. In other words, they're making this judge the richest guy. It doesn't have to do anything. He's going to be the richest guy in the state, making him a power broker. There shall be appointed clerks of the said courts who shall keep their offices at the capital of the said state. There shall be appointed for the said district one district judge, one United States attorney, and one United States marshal. The regular terms of said courts shall be held at the place aforesaid on the first Monday in April and the first Monday in November each year. For judicial purposes, the District of Utah shall be attached to the 8th Judicial Circuit, and only one grand jury and one petite jury shall be summoned in both of the said courts. So this is where they demanded to have a state grand jury and a state petite jury. Now, those types of juries, those types of functions that are being called out here, those are common law processes. And so this last last sentence of this paragraph is something that we absolutely want to capture. So this is what it says. For judicial purposes, the District of Utah shall be attached to the 8th District Court, and only one grand jury and one petite jury shall be summoned in both of said courts. So in other words, in the Utah District as well as the 8th District Court, for having one grand jury. Why are these grand juries important? This actually comes under common law to have a grand jury, and it actually is a part of the Fifth Amendment. No person can stand in a trial to be tried for an infamous crime unless they're first indicted by a grand jury. Folks, I point this out, I don't do this enough on common law, but go show me your standing state grand jury. Go show me your standing county grand juries, or anywhere where a person has been charged with murder and is being tried for murder, where that person had an indictment by a grand jury before the trial began. Now, I just told you what the Article 5 of the Constitution, not the Article 5, what the Fifth Amendment said. I'm going to read it again. That it says, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense or be tried in, hold on here. Where's the grand jury? Oh, it's right there in the beginning. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury. So before you can actually go to trial for a capital crime or an infamous crime, you have to be tried and have an indictment by a grand jury. That's huge, folks, because many people have been going to jail without these indictments. Why? Because the grand jury requires evidence. In these trials, not by juries, but jury trials, where the judge controls the jury, in those trials, they allow and bring in what we call circumstantial evidence and or accusations, not evidence, where they basically, and we've seen this, if you've ever watched L&O, this is where they actually started bragging about the fact that they can actually get people convicted on circumstantial evidence. In other words, not true evidence, not true facts. And prima facie, they actually have to prove without a shadow of a doubt that they have the evidence that somebody committed a crime. Our legal system was set up where it was far better for 9 guilty people to go free than it is for one innocent man to go to jail. We as a society have become such a vengeful society that we would rather allow, you know, innocent men go to jail than allow a guilty man set free. We've completely converted and perverted our legal system. Maybe that's because there's so many reprehensible crimes. Well, the fact is, these reprehensible crimes, if you actually read it here, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime. That means that they were going to be hanged. You stole the horse, you got hanged. You know, you stole something that was really bad, you could be hanged. Thomas Jefferson had his facsimiles stolen by two guys. They were hanged as soon as they were caught red-handed with his stuff. Because those were the only two facsimiles in the United States at all, these guys had them. Everybody knew that they were Thomas Jefferson's, and so they didn't even waste the time to call a judge and lawyers or anything else. I think these guys even confessed, but they hanged them on the spot. Capital crimes were actually integral in our system, and yet we've allowed the placating and this tolerance of this progressive idea that everybody is, you know, everybody has a right to have what rehabilitation. Actually, when you have violated your right as a citizen, you've lost your rights as a citizen. In other words, when you commit a crime, you've hurt somebody, you've done harm to somebody, you kind of have, you know, on your own, have made yourself ineligible for being treated like a citizen. You should lose your citizenship. You should lose your right to vote. And that's how it was. Every state revoked every felon. If you committed a felony, you lost your right to vote. Now everybody reinstates that because they want felons to vote because they know they're corrupt. This is a part of the honor among thieves of the system we have. Okay, so Section 15, that the circuit court and district courts of the District of Utah and the judges thereof, respectively, shall possess the same powers and jurisdiction and perform the same duties possessed and required to be performed by the other circuit and district court and judges of the United States and shall be governed by the same laws and regulations. 16, that the marshal, district attorney, and district of and the clerks of the circuit and district courts of the said district of Utah and all other officers and other persons performing duties in the administration of justice therein shall severally possess the powers and perform the duties lawfully possessed and required to be performed by the similar officers in their districts of the United States, and shall, for the services they may perform, receive the same fees and compensations allowed by law and other similar officers and persons performing similar duties. Section 17, that the convention herein provided for shall have the power to provide by ordinance for the transfer of actions, cases, and proceedings and matters pending in the Supreme or District Courts of the Territory of Utah at the time of the admission of the said state into the Union, to such court as shall be established under the Constitution to be thus formed. In other words, they're really holding their hands. They're really telling them that you're going to transition all of what you're doing now, and it's now going to go into these courts. And so it's sad, one, that they're telling them to do this, and obviously, if it's not obvious of what they had to do, then the complexity of what they're doing or the reason that why would people even think about doing these things, right? If they have to tell you, then there's something that is standing out as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't pass the smell test. And so they basically go through all of this. And it says, let me see here, and no indictment, action, or proceeding shall abate by reason of any change in the courts, but shall be proceeded with in the state or United States courts according to the laws and thereof respectively, that all cases of the appeal or writ of error heretofore prosecuted and now pending in the Supreme Court of the United States upon any record from the Supreme Court of said territory, or that may hereafter lawfully be prosecuted upon any record from said court, may be heard and determined by the Supreme Court of the United States, and the mandate of execution or of the further proceedings shall be directed by the Supreme Court of the United States to the circuit or district court hereby established, within the said state from or to the Supreme Court of such state, and the nature of the case may require, and the circuit, district, and state courts herein names shall respectively be the successors of the Supreme Court of the territory as to all such cases arising within the limits embraced within the jurisdiction of such courts respectively, with full power to proceed with the same and award mezzanine or final process therein, and that from all judgments and decrees of the Supreme Court of the territory mentioned in this act, in any cases arising within the limits and proposed state prior to the admission, the parties to such judgment shall have the same right to prosecute appeals and writs of error to the Supreme Court of the United States as they shall have had by the law prior to the admission of said state into the Union. So, in other words, they're basically saying you can kind of, you're going to do kind of what you do before, and the same people are going to do this. In other words, you're going to transition from a territory into a state, and it's still going to be legitimate, but it's going to be as a state, but you're not as a sovereign state. You're still under our control. You see this? This is what the really, that's what the real message is, that the Supreme Court and the federal government, even though they were in control as a territory, because they had the constitutional standing to make all needful rules and laws respecting the territory, they don't have the ability to make those laws respecting the state and how the state will create its own court. So, because that's why they didn't have this kind of crap in the previous Enabling Act, Section 18, that the sum of $30,000 or so much thereof as may be necessary, is hereby appropriated out of any money in the treasury not otherwise appropriated to said territory for defraying the expense of said convention and for the payment of the members thereto or thereof under the same rules and regulations at the same rates as are now provided by law for the payment of territorial legislature. So in other words, they're going to be paying for this convention that the state is going to have. And because he who pays the piper calls the tunes, folks. Why is the federal government paying for their own constitutional convention for the state? The state's constitutional convention. Now, people tell you that the states have to pay for the states do that and all of that. Technically, the Article 5 convention is within the Constitution. Technically, I'm going to say this, technically, because of that, one, the federal courts have jurisdiction, Congress has jurisdiction, and Congress has to pay for it because it's actually in the Constitution. And when you exercise those things that are in the Constitution and it is subject to potential compensation, then they need to fund it, because it is a constitutional mandate. That's what they're basically saying here in Section 18. Believe it or not, we didn't get through 19. We got to do 19, so we'll do that on Monday, and then we'll move forward with the Tory Acts. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.